I declare the meeting open at 5:30 p.m. I welcome councillors, management, members of the public in attendance to the City of Melbourne. We respectfully acknowledge that we're meeting on the traditional land of the Kulin Nation. This place is now known by the name of Melbourne. Melbourne is one of the great multicultural cities of the world and a significant meeting place. For the Kulin Nation, Melbourne has always been an important meeting place and location for events of social, educational, sporting and cultural significance. I take this opportunity to notify members of the public the meeting is being recorded and will be made available on the City of Melbourne website before close of business tomorrow. The unconfirmed minutes of the meeting will also be available from the City of Melbourne's website as soon as practicable. Should there be any queries relating to the conduct of the meeting, the documentation or submission process, please speak with a member of the Council business team after the meeting. Could I ask that all mobile phones be turned off for the duration of the meeting? And could I acknowledge that today is also International Women's Day? And note that our CEO is in fact one of the male champions of change, and that we are very proud that our city was one of the first to be a white ribbon city, and indeed I'm very proud to be an ambassador for the White Ribbon Foundation. Could I advise members of the committee and the public that where the committee makes a decision on the basis of fewer than six members voting in favour, the decision may be referred by a councillor to council for decision. I ask councillors to note that we've received requests to photograph, record audio and film from the Herald Sun 3AW, an independent production company. If any councillor has either a direct or indirect interest, as defined in the Local Government Act 1989, in relation to a matter to be considered by committee, please disclose the type and the nature of the interest prior to consideration of the item. Could I call on a councillor to move a resolution adopting the minutes of meeting number 75, held on Tuesday the 16th of February? Thank you, Councillor Oates. Seconded, Deputy Lord Mayor. I'll put that to the vote. All those in favour? That is unanimous. Thank you. Any matters arising from the minutes of the previous meetings? In that case, as at 3 p.m. today, the following submissions were received in accordance with the Council's Conduct of Meetings Local Law 2010. In relation to Agenda Item 6.1, 104 to 108 Hawke Street, West Melbourne, an item of correspondence from Colin Crowe and a request to speak from Colin Crowe. In relation to Agenda Item 6.4, submission to the Managing Residential Development Advisory Committee, items of correspondence from Tess Demiduke on behalf of RAID 3051 Inc. and Angela Williams. In relation to Agenda Item 6.5, Melbourne Planning Scheme Amendment C245, Queen Victoria Market Precinct Renewal, items of correspondence from Chris Thrum, Peter Papagiorgiou, Russell Mooney and Felicity Watson on behalf of the National Trust, and requests to speak from Chris Thrum and Peter Papagiorgiou. Is there anyone who'd like to speak to any item that I haven't read out? Thank you. Submitters are invited to address the committee for 3 minutes. The buzzer on the wall sounds at two, and then again at 3 minutes to signal to you that your time has concluded. In accordance with the Council Resolution of the 26th of March, a 15-minute period is provided at the beginning and the end of each meeting for members of the public to ask questions of us. Questions should not be greater than 90 seconds in duration. This is not the time to make submissions. Submitters are invited to address the committee at the time the relevant agenda item is committed. Is considered. Is anyone here who'd like to ask us a question? Chris first and then Shane, if that's okay.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. My question is in regards to international travel of yourself and councillors overseas to forums and conferences. Now, in particular, this is a follow-up question to Councillor Oak and also Councillor Aaron Wood. They mentioned when they tabled their report in regards to their travel to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, COP21 in Paris, that some of the benefits that they acquired from the meeting in Paris were still to be realised through meetings in Melbourne. And in light of the fact of Leonardo DiCaprio's courageous speech at the Academy Awards and the fact that the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration have advised NASA and the President of the United States that February 2016 was the warmest month on record, is it appropriate that councillors go to these meetings to further the knowledge of Melbourne? And what further benefits have Councillor Oak and Councillor Wood derived for Melbourne from their meeting?
Can I start, and then I'm happy to throw to both councillors. They're both going to be very modest, but I was extremely proud of their workloads and their contributions on our behalf through the City of Melbourne and ICLEI. We have been represented at these conferences, and I think Melbourne is a respected voice in this debate, and so we try to actually bring more than we take. And I would just endorse my total support of the work that Councillor Wood and Councillor Oak did on our behalf. But I might throw to them for the further part. Councillor Oak?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we want to take up all of the question time, knowing there's other questioners. A lot was in the report. A couple of the meetings that I mentioned in that report are still to come. One's tomorrow night and one is in 4 weeks' time. And the purpose of both of those meetings is it's all cities, not only across Australia, but mostly in Melbourne, talking about what can we as cities, not just the City of Melbourne, but all of the cities, you know, the municipalities in Victoria, how we can take advantage of the outcomes of Paris. And one of the biggest things is that joined up government. How can local government better work with state government, better work with the federal government through the various mechanisms that exist here, but also ones that have opened up internationally as a result of Paris? How can we work better together to better targets and to meet the national target, which is yet to be, I guess, ratified by our federal parliament anyway. But the biggest thing that we can do is to rally together and work across government to realise the ambitious targets that are needed to get to below 1.5 degree difference.
Councillor Wood.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. Thanks, Chris, for your question. I agree with Councillor Oak, and if you look at sort of recent reports too, there's talk obviously to further be endorsed and studied that we may have already hit the 2 degree temperature rise that's talked of for that should be sort of 30, 40 years' time. So I think the urgency is there. In terms of the benefits, they continue. Lots of presentations since we got back. One in particular that sort of springs to mind that was really valuable was the United Nations Association of Victoria. Their young professionals group is taking this on, really championing it. And I guess the other thing I should highlight too is that international reputation through C40, through the Rockefeller Foundation, through ICLEI. We're hosting the Executive Director of C40 here in Melbourne next week. He's only visiting two cities, I think, on that visit. And then when you look at sort of another city which likes to compare itself to us, that of Sydney, they are also a member of these international networks, and together they're the two of the largest population centres in Australia. They can also suffer the most impacts from things like urban heat and increased extremes of weather. So I think that the benefits in terms of, I guess, the coalition of local governments working together, as we said previously, the local government voice is very, very strong, but it's actually about practical examples of sort of all these numbers that float around, all the data that gets mentioned. What City of Melbourne and other cities are doing is getting on and tackling things like urban heat, stormwater capture, making our cities more resilient. So I certainly think that these international networks will continue to pay dividends into the future.
Thanks for your answer. Thanks, Chris. Shane.
Lord Mayor and Councillors, Shane Scanlon. On February 19, just passed, departmental officers told the Lower Yarra River Use Future Directions Group that Environment Minister Lisa Neville would be rejecting its recommendations for local waterways governance reform. While working group members have been heartened by the promise of some money for some infrastructure, a rejection of the broadly supported local port model would be a body blow to the economic development of Docklands. The Docklands Community Forum has identified waterways governance reform as one of its top three priorities, and support for the local port model is a policy objective of this council. As it happens, the minister is yet to make a decision on these recommendations, and a community delegation has secured a meeting with her to discuss the same on March 23. Given that this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to achieve waterways governance reform, will the City of Melbourne champion this issue, and if so, how?
Shane, maybe I might start, and I might throw to Councillor Wood, who's also done considerable work on this. I think we've recognised here for a long time the really cumbersome mess of regulatory authorities and pieces of legislation which govern the Yarra throughout its entirety. and that has to be regularised. Secondly, the history, as I recall it, was that there were two parallel processes, one a planning one under Minister Wynne and one a more environmental river use one under Minister Neville, which have now been brought together, which makes eminent sense to me. I'm not aware of where the Minister is or what she has said to that group. My view of the world would be strength to your arm. You're quite right. The policy position of this council has been the declaration of a local port. We would rather see that sooner than later. We think that is the eminently sensible way of managing our part of the responsibility of the Yarra and including into Docklands. I don't know if it's possible through that community representation that rather than rejecting such a proposal outright, it might be an argument to say, well, if you want a period that's an intermediary period where the City of Melbourne and Parks Victoria, you know, act to show you how such a model might work. I don't know whether that's a potential way forward, but our policy position remains that the declaration of a local port is the best outcome in every terms, for Docklands and the Lower Yarra. Could I ask Councillor Wood to comment as well?
Yeah, I support that, Lord Mayor, and it's part of our council plan, Shane, and indeed it was a question that we put to all candidates in the recent elections as well. So agreeing with the Lord Mayor that it remains our position to support that. I think having attended the last reference group meeting for the Yarra River Protection Act that's being looked at the moment, I think that we still have a way to go in talking with both ministers about the lower port declaration. I don't think that we should see this necessarily as the end of that discussion. I think what we need to do now is to work with all the other stakeholders to ensure that they understand the outcomes of that report and to work with them in ensuring that that this doesn't mean anything that should cause concern about management of the Yarra River's natural environs. It's very much focused around that one point of call for things like events or for business proposals in that much changed lower part of the Yarra. All councillors support that lower port declaration and in fact voted in favour of that. So we'll continue to work with your group but also through the reference committee and work with both ministers and hopefully, you know, go some way towards a resolution which is much more acceptable and much more in line with council policy as well.
Councillor Oak, do you want to add something?
Oh, I was just going to ask Shane a question. Is there anything specific that you'd like from us in the lead up to the meeting? I don't know, you're asking, are we willing to support? And obviously we do through policy and through other action, but I was interested if there was something else.
Councillor Oak, I think it'd be terrific to have someone like yourself or Councillor Wood along to the community delegation to put the case to the Minister on the 23rd.
Could I just take that on notice? We might need to, I don't want to strategise out aloud, but if it's a community representation, we wouldn't want to gazump, you know, your perfect right as a community group to put your point of view. On the other hand, we'd want them to know that we do support it. So maybe we need to talk about how that is best done, whether we do it through the community group and the city does it separately but in parallel, or whether it is done better. I'm just not quite sure which is the more effective, but outcome is the same.
Could we leave it summarised as that the council will be making representations?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Could I now call on Councillor Ong to assume the role of chair in relation to the planning portfolio?
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Tonight there are five reports from management for consideration under the planning portfolio. The first item is agenda item 6.1, planning permit application TP-2015-1183, which is 104 to 108 Hawke Street in West Melbourne. The councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? Nope. I now call on Colin Crowe, who requested the opportunity to address the committee. Colin, you have 3 minutes, and buzzer will sound after two, and you have 1 minute to wind up.
Thank you, Lord Mayor and councillors. I was just worried about the plight of the homeless in the city. I mean, on every street corner, there seems to be someone with a bed and a pillow, and it just seems tragic. And I read that the council has like a $10 million budget for buying parkland in West Melbourne to pull down warehouses and convert them into parks. And there was such a warehouse the council bought at 104 Hawke Street, West Melbourne, which is adjacent to the Adderley Street Park on the corner of Hawke and Adderley Street. And though it's only small, I just thought it'd be a symbolic step in trying to find a home for all these homeless people, which seem to be growing by the day. And I also understand that the City of Melbourne and Melbourne Uni seem to have some ownership of the Old Women's Hospital on the corner of Grattan and Swanston Street. And I thought, while it's being deliberated what to do with it, some homeless people could go and live there. Because I just feel, if we're supposed to be the world's most livable city, we can't have all these people living on the streets. But I realise you do a lot of work, but I just feel these people just need to get undercover somewhere. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Colin. Yes, thank you for that. On that note, I will move the resolution that's up on the screen, and then I'll make a comment. Councillor Wood seconded. I thank Colin for his commentary, and then most of us who are in the city, councillors and the public and the workers who work in the city, we see the situation all the time in terms of homelessness, which is not really specifically linked to what we are trying to do with this particular site, because it's part of a bigger strategy that we had with, in terms of Adderley Street, the parkland, which goes back about 4 years ago when the local residents said they needed more space. There's young families with children and there are dogs that want to go and run free. So we ended up coming up with a proposal to try to address a lot of those different issues. In terms of homelessness, I have to say that in the 7.5 years or so here, the council has been working very closely with City Mission and Home Ground Services, the Salvation Army, the authorities to try to address the problem, because we, the city, is the magnet. Because we have all the services here. And, of course, the chair of the People Portfolio Councillor, Richard Forster, has been driving that particular agenda item. And I think that's something that council will need to work with the agencies as well as the state government, where the Minister for Housing needs to look at these issues as well. So I would leave a comment on that. In terms of this particular proposal, I think the officers have done well to be able to acquire this old warehouse, which is actually not well used, and add to the open space, which in that part of West Melbourne has become a bit of a shortage. So we're doing this, and we're also doing some further near railway parade as well to address, I guess, the shortage of open space as densification in the city increases. So I'm fully commend officers for their work, and I fully support this. Councillor Wood.
Thanks, Chair. I agree with you. A lot of work is being done on the homelessness front, and Councillor for the People's City Portfolio can enlarge upon that further. That work has been extensive. It's never a solution or a problem that's easily solved, but that isn't to be wrapped up with this decision, which is actually about increasing open space in an area of the city, West Melbourne, that's been identified as not having the sort of access to open space that many parts of the other city enjoy. So this is actually a really good result. It's an opportunistic result. City of Melbourne doesn't have the budget to go out and purchase property on the open market regularly. In fact, it's something we do very, very rarely, because that open space fund, despite sort of having, you know, in the order of $10 to $15 million in it at any one time, is there for the entire city in terms of open space. So when you talk about the extensive growth that's occurred in the city, the densification of the city, and the need to keep on delivering more open space, the preferred option for the City of Melbourne is to actually turn asphalt into open spaces. And indeed, over recent times, we've turned 55 hectares of asphalt into new open space. So that's usually the preferred delivery model for new open space. This one, though, has been on the agenda for a very long time. Councillor Oak, in fact, has been involved in this one for a very long time. The community of West Melbourne will be very happy to have this new, much larger green open space delivered on their doorstep. So very, very happy to support this one.
Thank you, Councillor Wood. Further speakers to the motion? Councillor Forster.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to councillors for their comments in relation to homelessness. I agree with a number of the comments that Councillor Woods made. Open space is certainly at a premium in Melbourne, and when we have an opportunity to further develop it or acquire it, it's not something we should ignore too quickly. And this has been, as Councillor Woods said, an opportunistic outcome for us. So, again, one that we should support. I want to thank Colin too for his comments on homelessness. I think that genuine care and concern is a very human response to what we see on the streets every day, and it's not easy, I don't think, for anyone to walk past a genuinely homeless person and not feel real deep pity and concern for them. One comment that I would make, though, is that from my knowledge of having worked with these services that assist homeless people for some time, it isn't, unfortunately, as easy as simply finding a roof for a lot of people. For some people, that is simply not going to work. Believe me, if that was a solution, if that was a 100% solution to the problem, I think we'd be doing it by now. Regrettably, people who experience homelessness often require a lot more support and a lot more services than simply a key and a door. So that's what we've been turning our attention to, and especially working with individuals through the welfare agencies in the city to work with them individually to transition them through through homelessness by addressing their individual causes of homelessness appears to be the way that we get most success. And I know that the visuality of the problem doesn't seem to support that conclusion. But once again, I think Councillor Wong was correct too in his comments when he said that like many large cities, Melbourne is another city where once you do offer services here, homeless people need to gravitate towards it to access them. And that's something that we see year on year, unfortunately. So working with those individuals specifically to address their own causes of homelessness is the way to go. And on occasion, that is going to mean that, yeah, perhaps we can just accommodate them. On more often, though, more occasions, we're going to find that there are far deeper concerns than that, and that's what we need to resource and turn our attention to.
Thank you, Councillor Foster. Further speakers to the motion?
Thank you, Councillor Wong. It would be remiss if I didn't, you know, publicly say I endorse or and support the recommendation, given it was the photos of dogs petition that started this long process. And we shouldn't underestimate, you know, we shouldn't probably overstate how long it can take to get a dog park. But this process did start a long time ago, and it was a very creative petition from residents on Hawke Street wanting space to run their dogs, but also to spend time with the community and have a space where their children can play as well. And it was a very well-presented petition. Formally, I don't think it was a formal petition, given those photos, but it was a petition no less that we've taken, obviously, quite seriously. Not only have they got an extended space in this particular location, but they've actually got two parks in West Melbourne, which is severely lacking in public open space. So we've thought outside of the box quite a few times as a solution to the original petition. So I thank officers for all their work, but obviously thank residents for coming with us on a fairly long journey to get there, and look forward to the park being built.
Thank you, Councillor Oak. Any speakers against the motion? Further speakers? I will put this to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. I declare it carried unanimously. The next agenda item is agenda item 6.2, which is the planning permit application TP2015-1227, which is number 469-473 Cardigan Street in Carlton. Would officers like a presentation on this agenda item? Or would councillors like a presentation? I can ask the officers to do that. Now, officers doesn't want a presentation. All right, in that case, it's pretty straightforward. I'll move the recommendation and seconded by Councillor Leppard.
Watts.
Oh, Councillor Watts would like to say. You sure?
Yes.
Councillor Watts seconded. Pretty straightforward. A building that's given to council for use, and it's going to be a toy library. I think it's a good use. Anything that can be used back for the community, and especially communities with young families, is always something that's good. It's been this area where we have the Queen Elizabeth maternal and child health centre, so it suits the use of what fits in the area. So I'm not going to say too much. The report's been very clear, straightforward. I'm very happy to support it. Councillor Watts.
Indeed, I'm very happy to support it also. This is a very important example of residents finding their own solutions to problems. The toy library was formerly in Trades Hall, which was not the most easy place for young families to go, and two very interesting developments occurred that we were able to, the residents and council were able to negotiate with the Office of Housing, and what we have is a beautiful conversion, adaptive reuse of a chapel in this very important place, very close to Office of Housing apartments, a number of schools, public transport. It works very well, and I'm delighted that this is actually going to happen.
Thank you. Thank you. Councillor Watts, for the speakers, Councillor Main.
Thanks, Councillor Wong. Look, I'd just like to add a point that the commentary earlier about getting rid of asphalt and converting into parks. I was walking up the top end of Cardigan Street recently and walked past this former chapel and was interested to see what it was going to become. And also just noticed the ridiculous amount of asphalt to the immediate north of this site, which is probably appropriate given it's backing up a Vic Roads office. So you've got a Vic Roads office absolutely surrounded by far too much asphalt, which could be converted into a really nice park across the road from the Melbourne General Cemetery, where people could borrow from our new toy library and then go down to our new park and enjoy the toys. So I think it's one for Captain Asphalt Killer Rob Adams to turn his mind to and potentially deal with the asphalt there. But it's a great proposal, staffed by volunteers. It shows how we can be nimble and flexible with our community assets and community buildings and tap into the energies of our talent and the community to get up a program which is good for the community, won't cost council an arm and a leg, and will broaden the services that we're helping to facilitate to run across the community.
Thank you, Councillor Main. Any speakers against this motion? Further speakers to it? Deputy Lord Mayor.
I also agree with this resolution. It's been a long time coming. We've talked about a toy library here for quite some time. I think it's found the right home, and I'm sure the residents and the children are going to have a lot of fun.
Thank you, Deputy Lord Mayor. There are no further speakers. I'll put it to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. I declare it carried unanimously. The next agenda item 6.3, Ministerial Planning Referral, TPM 2015-15, which is 556 to 558 Lonsdale Street and 560 to 566 Lonsdale Street, Melbourne. I'd like to declare a conflict here due to my campaign team receiving a donation from the applicant. So I hand over the chair to...
Excuse me, Chair. I've also got a conflict here. The owner of this site was a donor to my campaign as well, and therefore this is a conflict of interest for me too.
I also have a conflict of interest, Chair, as the donor was a campaign donation.
And I too, Chair, have the same conflict.
And I too, Chair, have the same conflict.
And Chair, I also did have a conflict.
Councillors and members of the public, the meeting has lost a quorum, so this particular item can't be considered by committee. I just wish to advise that the administration will proceed on the basis of what is in the report and provide administrative advice to the minister. I should point out that in this case the council is not a decision-making authority but is an advisory body. Thank you.
Right. Back now on agenda item 6.4, which is the submission to the Managing Residential Development Advisory Committee. Would councillors like a presentation on this item? Or any questions? Nope. I call on councillor to move a motion.
Chair, can I move an alternative motion? That's the motion there on the screen, and it does go over the fold, but I will move that motion.
Just roll down the screen. Can you roll it back up? Okay. You move that? Happy to support that. I'll second that.
Thank you, Chair. Can I start by thanking officers for putting together the draft submission that we are considering as part of this process? I'm moving an alternative motion today because I think we can broaden our response to the Managing Residential Zones Committee above and beyond that which has been prepared for us today, but that's not a criticism of that which has been prepared for us today. I think it is one interpretation of what the committee is looking for, and as far as it goes, it's a very, very good submission. I'm just seeking to add to that submission. So can I, as I always do, thank officers for their thorough and diligent work. The process to date has been very flawed, obviously. From our perspective, I think that's fair to say that the end result is a little bit of a confusing one. The application of residential zones in the City of Melbourne, as we have it today, is generally lacking in a sound strategic justification, in my opinion. Councillors, residents will recall that when this process unfolded, the City of Melbourne put out its preferred application of residential zones based on its own methodology. It should be in areas defined by the MSS as stable, should be in heritage overlays, should be streetscapes that are 80% intact, and where those three measures are met, those areas should be neighbourhood residentially zoned. Now, that position was taken to the then Residential Zone Standing Advisory Committee, and that committee ultimately generally supported the City of Melbourne's position and referred it on to the Minister for Planning. At that stage, the Minister for Planning made various changes to the preferred application of residential zones, and I have no desire to politicise an already very politicised process there and to go into too much detail there, other than to say that it's quite clear to everyone who compares the City of Melbourne preferred position to the Residential Zone Standing Advisory Committee supported position and the Minister for Planning's final position, that there are various differences along the way. Now, the Residential Zone Standing Advisory Committee was quite critical of the City of Melbourne's preferred position. It said that our strategic justification for our position wasn't fully made, and that we should be considering reviewing the zones ourselves once the zones had had a while to be in place. But similarly, the Minister's final version lacked that strategic justification as well. So what you've got is you've got two processes, neither of which had a really solid, grounded strategic justification, conflating each other, resulting in a position today where the application of neighbourhood residential zone and general residential zone across the municipality doesn't make a huge amount of sense. Certainly, it bears little relationship to the principles inside the municipal strategic statement. Now, different councillors will have different opinions as to whether or not that is a problem. Certainly, many residential groups think it's a very big problem. I have heard and support a lot of arguments that suggest that the problem is possibly overstated. But whatever your thoughts, that's not what we're considering today with this motion. I'm just seeking to add three things to our submission, and that submission can then be considered by the Managing Residential Zones Committee. So adding to the submission, I'd like us to do more than the one paragraph that we've got in the submission at the moment saying that there's a difference between the City of Melbourne preferred application of zones and the final gazetted version, and actually spell out what they are, because that will allow the Managing Residential Zones Committee to do its job. One of its terms of reference is to is to review the process by which the new residential zones were implemented, and we will assist them by pointing out the variations along the way. The second thing is to register our concern as a council that the final decision, the gazetted version of the application of residential zones, was made without a strategic justification. So that's something that needs to be addressed. Again, councillors may have different opinions as to whether or not it's a problem that urgently needs to be fixed. However, we can admit, I think, that the lack of strategic justification is an issue that this committee should be exploring. And finally, a request that the committee does pay particular attention to this issue and provide advice. The advice technically goes to the minister, but the advice will hopefully be released publicly and will come to us as well, as to what the best process may be to move towards a situation where we do have a sounder strategic justification for the distribution of neighbourhood and general residential zones inside the municipality. To be clear, though, this motion does not commit us to commissioning any planning scheme amendment to do anything ourselves at this stage. We're just disclosing to this committee as much information as possible so that that committee, which is going to be comparing this council with all of our neighbouring councils, and every neighbouring council has a very different strategic justification for their distribution of zones, and it's a mess, we're asking this committee to provide us the best advice and giving them the best information so that they can provide that best advice. That's the justification for the changes here.
Thank you, Councillor Leppert. As a seconder, I'll add on a bit of comments on it. I think the officer's response, and taking on board what Councillor Leppert has said, the officer's response is to try to frame it in the scope of what this advisory committee is looking at, looking at the process of how, what happened to get to where we are. And I take the point, you know, there were political forces at play, not just at the state level, but at all local government level across metropolitan Melbourne. When these new zones were first brought up in July 2013, and it created a lot of discussions among councils, residents groups, businesses, owners, and homeowners, property owners, where what are the possibilities are. And I think, and I look back in the middle of that particular process, the amount of noise that came out basically overwhelmed the strategic approach that should have been taken as to what should be done properly in terms of the bigger agenda, of which at that stage was also driven by Plan Melbourne, which was a process that involved 10,000 people, all the municipalities, the planning experts from the various parts of metropolitan Melbourne. And the result of the outcome was that the easy way out was to just put NRZ across big chunks of the suburbia. City of Melbourne at that stage was also looking at its own MSS and also its own growth strategies, and to say, what are the areas we should allow some growth, and what are the areas we should protect, and the three principles that Councillor Leffert mentioned before was applied, and basically the old residential zone one was either moved to GRZ, and there was only some areas that managed to get into the NRZ sort of categories, which many people criticise us for doing that. But then I think if I look back now, and the officers were brave in saying that the rest of the surrounding councils went totally the other way, which meant that the bigger growth projections for the central sub-region under Plan Melbourne was not going to be achieved because whole areas were locked down. And if you look at the city of Moonee Valley, the area that is called GRZ is about the size of a 5-cent piece in the map, because that's not how equitable development is done to cater for the growth of a city that is very popular. Every year now we are seeing 109,000, the last year, 109,000 new residents coming into metropolitan Melbourne. Where are we going to house them? You know, if we lock down everything. So we've got to have a balance. So, and I look at it, this, hopefully this submission will help the advisory committee to say, here are the flaws that are identified in the process in 2013 and 2014, and if to get it right, there needs to be a stronger set of controls that the minister can implement. Because right now, it's all, I look back and it was a free-for-all. every council was doing what they choose to do to protect themselves. And that's not the way to go in terms of good planning and good strategic planning. So I commend the officers for putting that in. I think they could have gone a bit further, but I'm happy with it. Any councillors like to speak to the motion? Speak against the motion? Would a mover like to close? On that note, I'll put it to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands and declare to carry it unanimously. I must be moving too quickly. We're way ahead of schedule. I will slow down a bit now. Next agenda item 6.5, the Melbourne Planning Scheme Amendment C245, which is the Queen Victoria Market Precinct Renewal. Would councillors like a presentation on this agenda item? No? Okay, we're fully across it. So I have a couple of speakers on this one. First of all, I call on Chris Trum, requested opportunity to address the committee on this item. Chris, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Kenong. This is the report in regards to the Queen Victoria Market renewal, and commend the officers in compiling the report. It's a detailed report, very thorough. There were 156 submissions to the report, and I was reading through it, I noticed that there was, I don't think there was any mention of skaters or skateboarders in the report, and I think they are an important, vital part of the City of Melbourne and the community of Melbourne. So in my submission, written submission, I've suggested that we could, in open public spaces, devote some space to the skaters, to the skateboarding community. They're going through an emotional time at the moment in regards to what's happening in Lincoln Square. I think we're pretty cognizant of the passion that's around that square. Skaters would really love to preserve the square as it is. I'm sure that you're familiar with their position in that. But having said that, we have to be aware too that the City of Melbourne has been very productive in working with the skating community, like when they moved from Salyards to the skate park across the river. There was a lot of cohesion and work together in the community to make sure that that worked properly. So if it's at all possible, if there could be a deferment at least on the works at Lincoln Square and until after the Melbourne Skate sort of consultation process is done, I'm sure that will be appreciated by the general wider community. So in conclusion, it's important that we do acknowledge the artistry and skills that skaters bring to the City of Melbourne, and it is a very good report, and I commend officers involved in telling it to the committee.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions for Chris? Nope. You may sit your seat. Next, I call on Mr. Peter Papagiorgio to address the committee. Peter, you have 3 minutes.
Good evening, Lord Mayor, councillors. Thank you for giving me the time to talk to you. I'm taking this opportunity to make this submission to Agenda 6.5, which relates to the planning scheme, Amendment C245. And I wish to highlight that I own the land with my cousin and other owners left on that site at 446 to 450 Queen Street. I'm also speaking on behalf of the owners of 432 and 438 Queen Street. Now, my question is to the council here today. Does anyone have a conflict of interest in this matter? The council? The council owns the newly acquired land at the Munro site? No? Who owns the land at the Munro site? The Melbourne City Council? I'm asking that question. Sorry? The council has a conflict. No? Good. Okay. Look, the question I have today is that the proposed built form control seems to specifically favour the larger council-owned sites, while negatively reducing the development opportunity for smaller sites, such as our land and the other smaller sites. The council officer has not clarified whether this was specifically intended or is an accidental oversight within the drafting of the control. And I actually did a sketch-up model of what the council's proposing for this Victoria Market precinct. The properties that are large and green belong to the Melbourne City Council. And they're proposing to rezone it so that they can sell off the land to developers, whilst at the same time, the remaining four properties that are in yellow are restricted into what they can do with their sites. I ask if this is unfair, unfair and impartial, and should the council be permitted to make these decisions, seeing that it's the responsible authority and at the same time has a major interest in this site.
Peter, your time is up and
thank you.
Your points have been made. Thank you. Okay. I'd like to move an amended resolution which includes a fourth section to what management has put up. So at 6.4 is an addition to the recommendation. We agreed that we're going to write to them. Oh. Councillor Leppard seconded that. Thank you. The speaker is Chris on skateboarding. I think it's a bit out of the scope of the original Queen Victoria Market strategy and a master plan, but I suggest you might take some further discussions with the project team on those ideas. I understand where Mr. Papagiorgio is coming from. Yes, the planning scheme amendment looks at the whole market precinct in terms of trying to look at what the possibilities. And it is not always possible that smaller sites in their own right could be developed because there are planning rules and controls that looks at both height and setback. In this particular C245, we don't have a specific height control, but they're more on setbacks and tower separation controls. However, that does not mean that the number of owners involved in that to end up with some sort of consolidation if they think about some future redevelopment. It is not all possible in the city that we know that since the C262 planning scheme amendment came in place, many small sites are no longer able to be considered even for development. So it's not just the C245 that we're talking about. But we take your point on board that it does say that when with larger sites, you've got more flexibilities. And the smaller sites, of course, you need to think carefully how, if you really want to develop it. It's not meant to be what they call negatively written in such a way to disadvantage anyone in particular. Council does have a plan for the Queen Victoria Market. We have been consulting this plan for the last 3 years or so, and it's gone through a number of consultations. Of course, in the consultation, not everyone's always on the same page. The submissions, 156 submissions that we've received, it's important that we make sure that they get forwarded in their fullness to the independent panel, and that's why I've added in point 6.4. We can talk a lot about that. I mean, the panels, like Chris has said, you read through the report, you look at all the various issues. There are some valid issues in there that are brought up, and I think there are questions about sunlight, the position of the visitor centre. But some of those things are actually contractually put in place between the City of Melbourne and the state government a few years ago as part of getting that whole transfer of land and the conditions for us to do the Franklin Street connections and the car park down at Franklin Street South. So there are a lot of contractual agreements that are in place, which I can't go into the detail of here. But I think that but it's necessary for us to continue on the master plan that we have been talking about for 3 years. And this is another step in it. In once the minister has appointed an independent panel, that's the next process for all parties who are interested to continue their consultation and their submissions. And we just want to see the project finish so that we have a sustainable long-term Queen Victoria market that is sustainable for the future. Councillor Leppard.
Thank you, Chair. The conflict question is an interesting one because whilst, as Councillor Mayne suggested earlier, under the Act it's very, very clear that Council does not have a conflict of interest, and we're not, by the way, acting as the responsible authority for any application. We're acting as the planning authority at the moment. Council as a whole does not have a conflict of interest. Certainly there's a perception of a conflict because we are changing the built form controls, and a large site within this area is two large sites in this area are sites that we own. And if you consider that we own, you know, the market itself, then it's more than two, but the two prime development sites are sites that we own. For that reason, you'll find in the report that one of the reasons why there have been no changes made to the form of the draft planning scheme amendment that the panel's going to consider is that at this stage, officers are recommending to us that we not tweak it, but that we give as much authority to the independent planning panel as possible to consider all submissions, to consider the council's draft planning scheme amendment, and to give us their very, very best advice as to whether or not council's going down the right path. Now, that's a tricky thing because it looks as though council is railroading this in a sense. We've had lots of submitters say that the fact that council hasn't adopted any changes to the draft planning scheme amendment at this stage is proof that we're railroading this through. I don't think that's the case. I think the stronger argument here is that it is fair that the independent planning panel considers all submissions on their merits, including the council's proposal, and considers them that way. But I understand both sides of this argument, and certainly of the 156 submissions, there's a big theme coming through here that council needs to be very careful about perceptions of conflict, and we do. It's why the Munro site process has got the most robust probity controls around it that I've seen on this term of council and that we've seen in the City of Melbourne for many, many, many years. And it's why we do have to be careful about these processes. That said, I'm now going to just address the draft planning scheme amendment proper and the question before us, which is essentially to send this to panel. We have received quite a lot of criticism in the 156 submissions, and we talk about the draft planning scheme amendment being consistent with the Queen Victoria Market Renewal Master Plan. However, we have to acknowledge that that master plan does not cover the full study area of C245. The changes to Design and Development Overlay 14, which takes existing discretionary height controls and lifts those controls to uncapped heights, is something that I don't believe in hindsight Council has quite adequately set out the strategic justification for. This is stuff outside the Queen Victoria Market Renewal area, but it's inside the C245 Planning Scheme Amendment area. We've had a lot of criticism for not setting out the strategic justification, and I do agree with a lot of that criticism. However, We have to also acknowledge that the height controls in DDO 14 as they currently stand simply are not working. There are three very good examples of that. There's a 30-metre discretionary height control at 155 Franklin Street that now has an 88-metre tower on it. There's a 30-metre and a 60-metre discretionary height controls at 118 Beckett Street that now has a 143-metre tower on it. And there's a 30-metre discretionary height control at 366 William Street, which now has a 122-metre tower. The planning permit has been issued. It hasn't been constructed yet, but a planning permit has been issued. The two previous examples, the construction has been completed. So the cat's been billed. The planning controls in that area simply are not working. In hindsight, we should have made the case before we went to exhibition as to why we need to review those height controls. However, we're now making the case during the exhibition stage. So we're going to cop that criticism, and we're going to consistent and keep our very, very tight timeframes, and they are very, very tight because they need to be, and refer all of this to panel. But I do want to, you know, give a nod to that very strong theme that's come through all of those submissions, saying that we haven't set out the strategic justification for these changes, and whilst we have explained exactly what they're going to be in the exhibited version of this planning scheme amendment, I agree that we could have consulted on these prior to the exhibition. I also think that the last thing I'll say on this is that I also think that the criticism is a symptom of the expansion of the capital city zone from La Trobe Street up to Victoria Street. That capital city zone, coupled with the DDO 14 controls, the discretionary height limits, and Matthew Guy's, let's be honest, Matthew Guy's very permissive approach to approvals of planning applications in the area has meant that those DDO controls simply haven't worked. So I think that a lot of the criticism we're seeing from many of our submitters saying, why aren't you keeping to those existing controls, is a symptom of the fact that the capital city zone has expanded, and that zone coupled with the discretionary controls has meant that those controls have been very, very weak. That's my personal opinion. I know that other councillors won't necessarily agree with me. What we're doing here, though, is we're fixing a lot of that, and the mandatory controls around setbacks in particular are much, much, much stronger than anything we've seen before. We're going to see human scales at the street that is an improvement. We're going to see tower separation mandatories that are an improvement. We're going to see streetscape setbacks that are an improvement. So whilst the DDO 14 changes, I don't think we've set up the strategic justification for them, I personally think that the changes are justified, and we do need to proceed with it for on that basis. I was toying with another outcome, but I think that I'm happy for it to proceed. So let's see what the panel comes up with. Let's not make any changes today. Let's ask the panel to be as forthright and as possible when they scrutinise every aspect of this amendment. There is a perception of conflict, so let's not change it now. And this change here that Councillor Rong has suggested at Part 4 really highlights the fact that we do want the panel as well to very seriously consider every single submission that's been made, and every submitter will have every opportunity that they can to make their case.
Thank you, Councillor Lappert. Speaking to the motion, Councillor Main.
Thanks, Councillor Ong. The only other points I'd like to add, and I agree with my colleagues substantially. Peter, we didn't own the Munro site when we first publicly articulated our vision for a changed height regime on that site. So we didn't control the fact that the private owner put it to market. We said we're an interested buyer, and we publicly disclosed our vision for how controls might work on that site, and then we won a competitive auction and we spent $80 million if you include everything to get that, and with the other site we don't actually have title at the moment. The other site is actually still controlled by the state, and we have to deliver the Franklin Street connection and other things before we get title and before we can realise it. So it's not as if council had two long-term holdings abutting the market and said, right, this is how we do it. We didn't control either, and we negotiated in both situations to improve our options, to have greater control on development abutting the market, and to help fund a $250 million spend. And if we didn't have some asset realisation from those two parcels, we'd be jacking the rates up a lot more and slugging all ratepayers to deliver the biggest spend capital project in council's history. So it is a part of the financing plan, but we're very respectful of the controls that need to be there, and Councillor Leppard is right about setbacks and tower heights and things that have been proposed in section 245. Nothing like some of the indulgences that were accommodated by the former planning minister. We've been very sensitive to be seen to be very responsible. So I agree that potentially on DDO 14 we maybe should have articulated it a little more clearly, but I think ultimately, you know, if you say we have got a conflict, but we're not the decision maker. So the panels are very influential. We're not asking the minister to do a quick fire section 20.4, just approve it. We're going through the long drawn out panel process. That panel is professionals. They will look at your position, they will look at all positions, and then ultimately the minister will decide, and again it's someone else. So in my view, that conflict is managed. It's obviously not legal, but it's certainly perceived, is managed by the fact that it's actually independent advice and then a separate decision maker when council is the proponent of the planning scheme amendment. So for, I guess for all those reasons, I think we've done the right thing to not propose any specific changes. I like Councillor Wong's amendment to present all of the submissions directly to the panel to show that we respect them and that they should be heard. And of course, all individual submitters, yourself included, Peter, can go back and do another submission. You might have heard something tonight which is a different view, and do another written submission, and then you'll be fully considered by the experts. So I think it's a fair process, but we also need to continue to progress a long overdue renewal of the Queen Victoria market, while at the same time not sending the council broke. And that is what the councillors as a whole, and with the support of our excellent officers, are attempting to navigate through whilst being transparent and fair and respecting good process.
Thank you, Councillor Main. Further speakers to this? Lord Mayor.
First, as a little side note, I'll just respond to Chris about skaters. While I'm not sure that QVM is the spot, I can assure Chris that where it's appropriate and we are doing capital works, that we do negotiate with the skater community about what might be appropriate for their use. So that is taken into account, not perhaps in this project, but in many others of the capital works projects where we think it's appropriate to deal with the skater community. I won't repeat three councillors who very well summarised Councillor Leppard on the panel process, Councillor Ong's amendment to make sure that submitters are advised that their objections and concerns will be passed directly to the panel for their consideration, and of course they have the right to address the panel as well, and Councillor Main's excellent summation of the principles that were espoused by the council prior to council ever acquiring the Munro site, and his addressing of the conflict of interest issues as well. I will make one further point, however, and that is, I think Councillor Leppard is right, that there needs to be a strategic justification for C245. And essentially, we are asking for a change. We're asking for the fact that what has previously been a kind of a saucer development with the market at its centre with comparatively low rise all around it, is that the appropriate framing for Queen Victoria Market? Or rather, should the market be framed by a city edge which would allow greater height? And that is a question that will be before the panel, including the submissions that have been put before it, that are before us today. But that is a change, and we need to explain why that is a better outcome for the market in terms of its place in the city and preserving it. One final thing I will say, and I do not understand one part of the National Trust's submission to us tonight. It's a very brief one, but it makes a very large claim, talking about this amendment resulting in the total erasure of the full historical extent of the market site and former cemetery. I find that a little baffling, given that we are concurrently pursuing World Heritage listing for the market with all the strictures that apply there, with the full support of the federal minister. So I'm not quite sure how that how that plays out with that statement. I'm not sure what they mean by the full historical extent of the market site, given that at one point the photographs demonstrate that sheds actually covered the entirety of the market site. So what is the historical extent of the market site? And as for the bit about the former cemetery, in fact, our intention, and it has been clear all the way through, is exactly the opposite with the cemetery. I mean, we wish to be extremely respectful of Melbourne's first cemetery. It's hardly respectful to have an asphalt car park over the top of it. And what we have been saying in our literature and our information is about returning that to public open space with appropriate commemoration of that cemetery and a more appropriate community use. And so I'm not sure how that's the erasure of the cemetery. So the National Trust say that they will make a submission to the panel. I think they will need to make a case, given the public information that we've made available, about why that statement has any validity, because I just don't understand it. But, you know, the panel process, as other councillors have said, is the appropriate, rigorous testing ground for C245, including the objections that have been raised. Finally, and on a much lighter note, I was pleased to see that one Boo Radley made a submission to us, given that, as I recall, he was the reclusive near neighbour of the Finch family in To Kill a Mockingbird. But nevertheless, I'm sure it was a very valid submission to this whole process.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Any further speakers? Councillor Watts.
Thank you. I'm not preparing to trivialise what we're dealing with here. This is a very serious matter. I'm completely baffled, to tell you the truth, about the way in which this whole development has, and the process has evolved to one in which, I mean, we have a lot of professionals on this case, both on the council, as you've heard, and in the community. We've got world's best practiced in this kind of large-scale development, and yet we seem not to have achieved a very satisfactory process, and that worries me. I'm not prepared to debate the chronology of whether we thought of the Munro before or after we put in the bit. All of that's irrelevant. And I'm not prepared to speculate around the impact on rates if we didn't go ahead with this or whatever. This is completely irrelevant. This is a regrettable position that we're finding ourselves in, that we have to defend our position so long and hard to our constituents, people who actually have what, there's an expression, skin in the game. We've got people who actually own this properties around the place. It's splitting hairs, but absolutely factual about, you know, do we have conflict, don't we have conflict? It is a very fraught business that we find ourselves engaged in. The best thing that's happening, as far as I can see, is that we do have this independent panel, and we are pushing towards informing this panel as well as we can. My fear is that the City of Melbourne, legitimate position, I'm absolutely sure, putting together a sophisticated submission, may not be regarded in the same way as the 156 ordinary constituents, if you like, who are putting their positions forward. I'm hoping that they actually get the hearing, or let's say the reading that we get. That will be in the hands of the panel, and we can hope for the best. So I'll be in favour of this motion, but with concerns.
Thank you, Councillor Watts. Further speakers? And if not, I'll quickly close this debate. Councillor Wood.
Thanks, Chair. I actually wholeheartedly support our purchase of the Munro site. I think it's fantastic, in fact, that Council has ownership of these two significant sites. The services, the family services, the community services, the setbacks, the tower separation that Council Leppert's articulated, these are all things that Council has at its forefront because we want to deliver a great interaction with the whole reason for this process, which is to better a jewel in the crown of Melbourne. So the intention here all along is actually to enhance the market, to deliver a better market experience. I think Peter's comments, your comments are well made. I think, you know, I wouldn't question the integrity of an independent panel. I think the process will be very robust and very sound. Each submitter will be given equal weighting, as they always are. I think to question the integrity of a panel is a place that I wouldn't want to go to. So I think the great thing about this, the 156 submissions that we've received show the importance of getting this right, show the importance of the Queen Victoria market to Melbourne. And I think what we'll get out of this, through the input of all of those stakeholders, through the input of council, through the input of independent experts, through the absolute strength and probity that's been applied to this process, we'll end up with a market that will be here for hundreds of years to come, instead of a market which was starting to struggle. So all the good aspects are being talked about, are being preserved. The sheds, the great mix of businesses, the food offerings that are there, the chance for new open space. And looking through the submissions, I don't think, aside from a couple, from a personal point of view, that they're unworkable. I think, you know, things like ensuring that that open space is green open space, I personally support that. I think they're really good inputs to this process. So I can assure you that, you know, although the perceptions and the talk of perception of conflict, I think Councillor Leppert and Councillor Main have addressed those very well, I feel extremely comfortable in the integrity, the independence of the process and the role that Council is playing on behalf of our ratepayers. And the fact that the whole intention here from start to finish is about delivering a market that's sustainable, delivering a market that's going to be here for hundreds of years to come, and ensuring that the interface with that market is such that it delivers the family services that that part of the city needs. So I don't share those concerns. I think we've got a great process here, a process which is going to be extremely robust, very transparent, and a process that you're all welcome to continue to comment on and have done to date.
Thank you, Councillor Wood. Now, I'll close off. I'm listening to all the debates, and it's like councillors here, we've read the 156 submissions. A couple of points I just want to reiterate. C245 relates to the five key elements of this planning scheme amendment, which is the change of the public use zone, the DPO introduction, DPO 11, removal of DDO 14 to ensure no sunlight on Flagstaff Gardens under this new scheme, and to introduce the built form controls specifically. Some submitters are saying these buildings, the nearby residents are saying it's going to block certain views and certain other things. And I take the point on board that some of the controls are a bit tight, which means the smaller site could become a problem. The process of going to the independent panel is very simple. For those of you who have understood how this works in planning scheme amendments, if council gets a report back from the independent planning panel that says you need to do this, 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 I can tell you, we ignore it, it will get rejected by the minister. It has happened in the past. So the process is very stringent and well above board. Oh, I just got to also make a point. Actually, 6.4 wasn't a suggestion from the Lord Mayor. I've just put it up under my name, so I think I can't take the credit for that. Now, in terms of DDO 14 and the strategic purpose, I could say that we could spend a lot of time discussing what is the strategic intent or the justification, but there's a very clear point. If we had done DDO 14 just covering the Munro site, Mr. Papagiorgio's site and all the others would be excluded, which will even be worse and unfair, because we allow certain controls or unlimited height controls and certain things in the Munro site, and then everything around surrounding to the DPO 11 is untouched. That would not be fair either. So it's got to be done in a way that it's fair for all the properties within the DPO. Now, and I look at this, comments coming about the certain heights and all that in the developments that are proposed. The most important thing about this particular project, if you look back at the master plan, it is about what happens at the ground level. What happens in the space that you go up Queen Street? How the buildings are kept low profile, on the edges.
the square, the public open space, because those are the important things. Instead of a bitumen-covered car park, it would become a public open space and the 700 spaces go into a building. Isn't that a better outcome? Because what happens is important. That's what happens on the street level. And we've always talked about that in the city. Why is it such a great city? Because getting down at the street level, using the city, moving around, the open space, the facilities, the interactions. And all we talk about is what's up there. That's where people live. That's not where people get out and do things. So I think the master plan that we've gone through for so many years now, it's a very good master plan. And this planning scheme amendment is to make sure that happens well with the controls and make sure that all the things that will be built well. So I'm fully supporting of this. On that note, I'll put this to the vote. All those in favour, please raise your hands. I declare it carried. And now I can hand it back to the Lord Mayor for the rest of this meeting.
Thank you, Councillor Mayne. Let's wait till people leave. Thank you. There is one item of general business to be considered, and that is a notice of motion standing in Councillor Foster's name, and I ask Councillor Foster to move the motion standing in his name.
So moved.
Thank you. Is there a seconder for that motion? Councillor Watts, thank you. Councillor Foster.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Well, it's certainly unfortunate that we need to be dealing with a matter like this, but it's important that we do. Recent reports about the use of the Lord Mayor's credit card have done nothing for the reputation of the council or the confidence that ratepayers should be able to have in the council and the Lord Mayor, so we do need to take a look at how this has happened. I do appreciate, though, that the Lord Mayor's made a couple of admissions to a couple of mistakes, which I do think is a good thing. But there should always be a safety net for these sorts of errors, an administrative mechanism that restricts the chances of these sorts of mistakes occurring in the first place. Asking our officers to bring us some advice on how we might improve our processes is the right thing to do. Clearly, it's not enough to merely rely on disclosures. Finding out that something bad has happened after something bad has happened simply doesn't prevent it from happening. This motion puts the focus rightly on prevention, the sort of prevention that doesn't rely on any one individual, but on a process.
Councillor Watts.
The word that I would use in regarding this matter is regrettable that this in any way reflects on Town Hall and the way business is conducted here. So I'm very pleased to have this investigated in a rigorous manner, a report prepared. We want this council, as the Capital City Council, to be well regarded and model best practice. And clearly something is amiss now. So this is why I'm prepared to support this motion in the interests of improving what we do.
Thank you. Is there a speaker against the motion? Councillor Mayne.
Lord Mayor, if I could direct a question to you. In terms of going forward from where we are now, I'm just interested to hear from you as to whether you're committed to fully comply with Council's expenses policy.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, look, in light of that commitment, I'm speaking against this motion and foreshadowing an alternative motion. And just for the benefit of councillors and the gallery, I'd like that to be displayed on the screen while I speak. So Councillor Foster is proposing a six-week process, drawing in management into an issue that's been quite heavily politicised. And I think as Chair of Finance and Governance, after consulting widely with management and with colleagues across the board, that there's a cleaner and clearer, a more effective solution that we can reach tonight. And that is to note the Lord Mayor's commitment to fully comply with our expenses policy going forward. And point two, to invoke the old sunlight is the best disinfectant motto, so that we, through this committee, request management to, from January on, disclose whether there have been any private expenditures initially incurred on the council-issued credit card before being reimbursed on receiving the monthly statement. So in other words, that if the practice that has been raised in the press is to continue, it will be visible every quarter and specifically identified in our online disclosures, as we currently do, which is best practice disclosure across Australia in terms of council expenses. So I think that I think it would make sense to vote down Councillor Foster's notice of motion. It was, I would have appreciated perhaps having had a discussion with Councillor Foster before the motion was put in, but unfortunately that wasn't possible. But I've subsequently spoken to Councillor Foster and to colleagues and to management. And as Chair of Finance and Governance, I think this is the better way to go, rather than an issue which has been publicly discussed for what, 9 days now, to then have it kicked down the road for another 6 weeks when there's a very clear and obvious solution, which is to recognise the commitment we've had from the Lord Mayor tonight and also to have online disclosure of the practice which has been raised in the media. I'd also note that I've had a look at the data and I think it's over the last 19 months or so that the monthly expenditure has been, I think, only about $50 a month in terms of the private expenditure then later reimbursed, compared with the press reports, which picked a period of time which was running at some $660 a month. So for mine, the data says that the practice that has been raised as a concern in the last 20 months is operating at one-fifteenth of the level that was reported in the press. So for me, internally, the issue has been sorted. Internally, for the last 20 months, it's not material, and we should close the book on this issue with a good transparency reform and respect the undertakings that the Lord Mayor's given on both the fact that, yes, every single last dollar has been repaid, and that, yes, he has given a commitment tonight that in future quarterly reports that he will fully comply with the expenses policy, and if there's any deviation from that, it will be fully apparent in our online disclosures. So that's why I'm recommending councillors vote against Councillor Foster's motion, and then I won't repeat the debate if the alternative motion is moved, but I've put the arguments for the cleaner, quicker and faster and more effective and more collegiate alternative motion.
Is there a further speaker to debate? Councillor Levitt.
Thank you, Chair. I'm inclined to take the advice of the Chair of Finance and Governance of this committee. Part two of the foreshadowed motion, which I know we're not debating directly now, but obviously it's linked, interests me greatly. It does allow us to resolve this issue, and it also, part one, of course, picks up on the statements that have been made today, as well as, I think, statements that have been made previously. I think the other improvement, of course, is the change of the PIN, which is always helpful. So I'm inclined to support the foreshadowed motion, so I'll be voting against this as well. I'm much more interested in getting the right outcome than I am in extended political posturing, and so I'm very happy to arrive at an outcome today. We've got a lot of work to get on with as a council, and so let's not have this as a distraction. Councillor Mayne's got a very sensible transparency measure in front of us, so I'll be moving towards that motion as well.
Further contribution to debate? Does the mover wish to conclude debate?
Yes, thank you, Lord Mayor. I'll just pick up on a couple of comments of Councillor Mayne. I note his comments that it may be cleaner, but I've got to say the alternative motion, in my view, is in no way clearer. It sheds no light on the process that has failed here, because it isn't just about the Lord Mayor and his mistakes. It's about process, and it offers little, if any, protection against this happening again. The Councillor Mayne himself has confirmed that this is still happening. In whatever value, transactions are still going through of a personal nature. So let's just go back to some of the facts that that all this started with. The Lord Mayor was quoted just yesterday in Fairfax Media saying, I made a couple of mistakes and I rectified those at the time. But that's not entirely true, is it? It wasn't just a couple of mistakes. It was 70 mistakes. 70 process breakdowns as much as they were 70 mistakes. 70 apparently mistaken transactions that had to be reimbursed. And it wasn't just over a bad week or a bad month or even a bad year. This conduct extended over 3.5 years. So we have to take this into account when we think about how we're going to rectify the situation. It's not going to be done merely with an undertaking. And it's not going to be done with something as simple as changing a PIN either. Why didn't that happen 3 years ago? It's a pretty easy thing to do, yet it didn't happen, and there's only a very recent undertaking now by the Lord Mayor to do so. It seems like nothing more than a political stutter now, and it's pretty easy to imagine what might have happened if this situation hadn't have been reported in the media. Another question that we have to consider is what has happened between the two cards? We know, and I accept the Lord Mayor's explanations, that they may well look very similar, but how many council transactions appeared on his personal credit card then? We don't have an answer to that. Finally, if you're genuinely interested in good governance, and this is what I would remind councillors, good financial controls and accountability, why wouldn't you want qualified officers to have a look at our processes and try to improve them? What is so great about the mere change of a PIN that somehow outperforms a proper, cogent review of our own protocols? It beggars belief that an undertaking to do something so minor like changing a PIN, something that most of us have already done and that should have been done by the Lord Mayor some 3 years ago, seems perfectly satisfactory as an alternative to proper administrative advice. 3 years, 70 transactions, $28,000 ratepayer dollars, no independent review or oversight, all because he's going to change his PIN. It's not good enough.
Before I put the vote, could I ask one question of our Manager of Governance, because there were some things raised in there about the process. Does the city have a view about the process that has been followed so far?
I'm satisfied with the process that we have internally, and I'm also satisfied that I have no recommendations for improvement.
Thank you. In that case, of course.
Just another question for you, Keith. Are you the one overseeing that process at the moment as head of governance?
I'm the one that ultimately signs off on the accounts being paid, yes.
In that case, I'll put the motion. Those who wish to support Councillor Foster's motion should vote yes. All those in favour? Councillor Foster, Councillor Watts. Those against? Councillor Louis, Councillor Pinner-Mortimer, Councillor Wood, Councillor Mayne, Councillor Ong, Councillor Leppett, Councillor Oak, Deputy Lord Mayor and myself, the motion is lost. In that case, we move to Councillor Mayne's motion, which has been foreshadowed. Councillor Mayne, do you wish to move that motion? Is that seconded? Councillor Ong, thank you. Councillor Mayne.
Thanks, Lord Mayor. Look, as I mentioned earlier, I think that this is a good governance reform. If there's a practice which is concern has been raised about, and Councillor Foster has raised it, given some colourful quotes in the media, made a few comments, a few tweets, and fully worked it for political purposes. But I think that if the data shows that the practice which is in issue is running at $50 a month, which is just not material. And then if you've also got a solution which is saying, well, we'd actually rather it was zero, and I think that's pretty clear from the public discussion and from the Lord Mayor's comments tonight, that everyone would rather it was zero, but of course sometimes there will be overs and unders. A card might not work overseas. I mean, all of us have got a cab charge, so all of us have got a credit card for taxis, all 11 councillors. Occasionally there's a private trip which is put on the card and reimbursed. The sky doesn't fall in, it's not the end of the world. The net cost to council is zero from the practice which is causing great dramatic political statements tonight. The cost to the council is zero. The policy talks about a monthly account will be provided to assist with reconciliation. And that's precisely actually what's happened. A monthly account has been provided and then there has been reconciliation. I mean, some of the press reports have suggested there's been some lump sum payment at the end of 3 years. That's absolutely wrong. It's been a monthly reconciliation payment, which, as of the last 20 months, hasn't even been material, $45 a month. So I don't want to, to have more distractions after 9 days, have another 6 weeks of political posturing over non-material trends in this issue. And I'd encourage Councillor Foster, and I'd ask him, as he's Chair of Finance and Governance, to not vote against a good motion which acknowledges the commitment that the Lord Mayor has made, which acknowledges that everything is being paid back on a monthly basis, and which supports a proactive disclosure that will reveal to everyone on a quarterly basis if the practice that he is so concerned about is continuing to operate. So I do hope that we can get unanimous support from councillors tonight for what is a proactive and positive intervention to solve an untidy issue and to close the book on this as it goes forward.
Thank you, Lord Mayor. I won't add much more to what Councillor Mayne has said. I think I take a few key points. The Manager of Governance, Mr. Keith Williamson, has said he's happy with the process. He does not intend to make changes to the process. I think that's an important point to consider. The other important point in my view is that there is no accusation that the Lord Mayor did any of these things on purpose, and he's admitted that he sometimes makes a mistake with that, and all expenses that are private have been repaid. I think it's true as what Councillor Mayne has said. It's media-driven, and we could actually make it even more media-driven and turn it into political, or we can say, here's a process that we say, through the Chair of Governance, and I'm the Deputy Chair, I think that's a good disclosure process, because we currently in the City of Melbourne disclose hell of a lot of stuff. You know, the quarterly reports show exactly how much each councillor used in spending on their communications, on their travels, attending conferences, and a whole lot of other stuff. So, and all the information's there, and this is to add to what's already publicly available. And I tend to agree with what Councillor Mayne said at the end. To vote against this alternate motion, in my mind, is to say, we are belligerent about pushing this agenda item that's driven by the media for whatever political purposes. So voting against this, in my mind, means there's another reason why you want to continue to perpetuate an issue that probably should be brought to an end.
Is there a further speaker to the motion? Councillor Watts.
Yes, I'd just like to make the point that, in fact, well, I don't think it's quite accurate to say that this is media-driven. The trigger for this is a regrettable oversight or some kind of failure of process, it seems to me. So I'm a little bit tired of, I think it's perhaps I've counted four or five references to politicisation. What we're dealing with here is a process which has been found wanting. And I will vote in favour of this motion. I'm in favour, as most people will know, of as much transparency as possible. But I'm also appalled that, as a council, we can't actually consider improvements to processes. We don't want this to happen. Like, there's a very simple thing that could be done, in that the Lord Mayor is the only councillor with such a card. None of this would have happened if the card was not with him. So never mind about all this reconciliation. We could simply consider all of the councillors having the same approach to credit cards, a reimbursement regime rather than a credit card. But they were the points that I would like to make.
Thank you. Is there a further contribution to debate? Councillor Foster.
Thank you. Thank you, Councillor Mayne, for the alternative motion, such as it is. I will support it. It's not without qualification, as you'd probably imagine, but I will support it. There's two main things I'd like to say about it. Firstly, look, I am quite amazed that this is in respect of the first part of the motion. I am quite amazed that some councillors seem to think that the Lord Mayor has done us all an enormous favour by repaying transactions that he should never have charged in the first place. I think that is quite amazing. Just as amazing is how some councillors seem to regard some motions as mere products of politicisation just because it doesn't suit their political ends. And that is just as amazing. Now, it's not about politics. It's actually about process. If we want this sort of thing to stop, it has to be a procedural stopgap that we put in place. Clearly, we can't rely on any particular individual to do it just on their own when this sort of conduct has been going on for so long. Again, in respect of the first part of the motion, as I would understand it, the Lord Mayor's already made these undertakings. He signed the Councillor Code of Conduct, as we all did. The undertakings are already there, yet somehow we're going to fix the problem by asking him to do it again. Didn't seem to work the first time. Nonetheless, I'll say it's certainly not a step backwards. It's probably a very small step forwards, and for that reason I feel compelled to compelled to support it. I don't think it goes anywhere near as far as what we could have done with the original motion, but nonetheless, it's probably better than where we started at.
Further contribution to debate?
I don't want to extend it any further, but I don't know where to start. I think that it's putting aside the I don't know, it seems very antagonistic, this debate, and this is unfortunate, where I actually think it is useful that Councillor Foster has put this motion on the table, that there was an issue raised, not, I believe, by us, but it was through the media, actually, through an FOI request, got this information. It's in the media. We need to show how we're dealing with it. The reason why I'm supporting this alternative motion is because it goes back to our expenses policy, which isn't just about the credit card. It's about all of our councillor expenses. And it is about the credit card, the taxi cards that we have. It is about expenses that we do incur as councillors, and sometimes they aren't entirely council related. So there are actually expenses not just around credit card use, but say like my Mikey, I get a small proportion of it paid for by council, but it has to be paid for upfront by council at start, and then I pay it back because that's just the way the system is. So there are things within our expenses policy which does mean council initially pays for things and then we have to reimburse. That's not to say that it is good practice that the Lord Mayor puts personal things on the council credit card, but sometimes these things happen, and I don't believe that our policy at the moment is at fault. The policy in place should be addressing that. And I think 1.2 is actually a step forward. It is an additional measure. And that it will specify where the... I believe this already happens anyway, but this, I believe, is a one step further with respect to the Lord Mayor's credit card. But I understand that when I make an expense claim and have to decide whether I have to pay it back or not, that is all on the record, and you can all see that I have paid 50% back of my Mikey card or whatever it is. And likewise, if we travel, we come back and you have to itemise it all and I pay it back. You know, the things that I know for sure are not council related. So I support this motion because I think that we do have a procedure in place, we do have a policy in place. It might not have worked, maybe it did, maybe it didn't, but I think that this nibs it in the butt now. I think we are acting by pulling it into the open, and I do think that Councillor Foster putting the motion on the table was a good thing to address an issue that was in the media, that wasn't, I believe, raised by us. But I think that this is a neater way of dealing with it. And I think that we've all now been fully reminded of our responsibilities as councillors with respect to the expense code of conduct that we've all signed up to, and I hope that we're all abiding by. And if we're not, this is a good reminder that we should. So I support the alternative motion for various reasons that have been discussed, but for the ones that I've also put on record.
Any further contribution to debate? Would the mover care to conclude debate?
Look, just in closing, look, I appreciate Councillor Watts and Councillor Foster saying that they'll support the motion. I think that's a good step, and I do appreciate that. Look, just a couple of minor points. I think I think the Lord Mayor needs to have a card. I think one of the reasons our Lord Mayor is such a great Lord Mayor for Melbourne is his network, is his reach, is his connectedness. So if he's meeting with a Boris Johnson or a Mayor Bloomberg or the Premier Daniel Andrews or the Prime Minister for a meal, and this happens, he can pay or they can pay or whatever. That, I think it's, we've only got about 6 cards in the organisation, and frankly, credit cards, I mean, you've got to have them. Sometimes you can only buy software with a credit card, and sometimes you can only lodge a magistrate's court fee, you know, with a credit card. So the organisation is very credit card light, even though it actually is the easiest and most efficient way to pay for things, and most people you deal with actually prefer that. But for some reason, there's a often media-driven anxiety about credit cards. So we are going as credit card light as we can, and I think the Lord Mayor should have a credit card, and we should have maximum transparency around the spending on that credit card, and we get even more transparency now. I guess the reason why I did mention grandstanding, Councillor Foster, is that as your independent chair of finance, not aligned with any political party or group, I was disappointed that you were making statements in the media, that you were putting up notices of motion related to my portfolio without consultation with me. And for me, that said, it was more politics and grandstanding than a genuine issue in the policy and respect to the portfolio holder and finding a way forward to fix it without doing Twitter references to Clown Hall or anything else. So I just felt that that's why I was personally grieved with the way you played this. I was quite upset about the way you played it. Seemed to be not particularly considerate of the overall institution, and therefore that was my position. But I appreciate that you've come around to hopefully supporting this motion, and I think we should now close the book on this and move on with substantive material issues that the council has to deal with.
Thank you. I'll now put that motion. All those in favour? That is unanimous. Thank you. Are there any items of general business? Sorry, that concludes the items of general business. Any items of urgent business? In that case, we provide, again, a period of 15 minutes at the end of each meeting. Would anyone like to ask us a question? In that case, can I thank members of the public for their interest and attendance and declare the meeting closed at 7:11 p.m.